Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. This hour, we're going to be talking about foreclosures. The rapid decline, our guest says, of the value of housing and the surge in the rate of unemployment has created the possibility of a perfect storm for foreclosures in the next few months. The precise estimates are not possible since the current crisis is so different from previous experience. But if the unemployment rate, and it's so darn close to that now, hits 10%, we could face an additional 1.4 million defaults. It's a situation that is in need of repair, and the administration's plan, our guest says, is incomplete. Professor Morris Davis is assistant professor of real estate and urban land economics at the Wisconsin School of Business, University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's worked as an economist at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, analyzing housing markets, developing a real estate pricing index, and outlining his research during briefings with former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan. He's widely published on issues related to the U.S. housing markets and is also a frequent lecturer. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Morris Davis at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Morris joining us from our studios in Madison. Email address is, and we thank you very much for being with us. Hello, Professor Morris.
Kathleen, thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, and, great. Yes.
Great. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
No, nothing.
Okay.
You can call me Professor Morris. That's fine.
Professor Davis is really right, but I'll call you Professor Morris Davis to start.
Either way,
you.
It's casual here.
Okay. Let's talk about the events that lead homeowners to default on their mortgage. You talk about this double trigger theory of foreclosure, which is what?
Yes. So the double trigger theory of foreclosure says that two conditions have to be present for a homeowner to foreclose on the house in most circumstances. The first is that the house has to be worth less than the mortgage. That's called the first trigger, and that's often called underwater. When the house is underwater, the house value is less than the mortgage. The second trigger is typically some sort of disruption to income, a health event, a divorce, or unemployment. And the research shows that most foreclosures occur when both of these triggers are present. And it's this double trigger phenomenon that makes all of us believe that we have the basically what appears to be the perfect storm for foreclosures occurring now and about to occur in the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm. And getting worse, perhaps, because of these darned unemployment numbers, which keep going up.
Right. Unemployment is a trigger. The unemployment rates are expected to rise to 10%. For 2010. That's higher than the current unemployment rate, and they're expected to remain above 9% in 2011. And to give the listeners some idea, during normal times, we would think that a normal unemployment rate would be on the order of 5%. So we're talking about an extra 5% of the labor force that has only unemployment benefits coming in as income. And 5% of the labor force is about 7.5 million people.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean, Professor Davis, that this administration will talk about what their plan is to deal with foreclosures, but you have to deal with that issue, but you also have to start some kind of significant jobs program while you're addressing the foreclosure problem?
There's a lot to that question. Let me separate the question into two parts, which is what should the administration do if it doesn't want to create a jobs program? And then the second part is there such a thing as an effective jobs program? So let's talk about the first part. The administration has believed that the foreclosure problem is a result of too many people with subprime mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason, if you just look at the published numbers, the reason that you might believe that that's the problem is as follows. The delinquency rate on subprime loans, that's a number like 12%. The delinquency rate on prime loans, that's a number like now nearly 3%. So you'd say, oh, subprime's the problem. Delinquency rates are 12%. Prime loans, they're only 3%. However, so many people have prime loans relative to subprime loans that prime loans are the problem. And to give you an idea, of all of the delinquencies now in 2009, the second quarter of 2009, only 30% of them are from subprime loans.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, people don't know that. Subprime is not the problem. I mean, it is a problem for 30% of the delinquencies. But whatever the administration is doing, it's missing out on the other 70%. And our belief, and these 70% have prime loans or, okay, so that other 70%, 50% of that 70% is prime loans, and the other 20% of that 70% is some government-backed loan like FHA or VA. So it's this other 70%. These people have totally sensible mortgages. They don't need their mortgage refinanced. What they need is a little bit of income assistance.
Mm-hmm. And so, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and none of the administration's plans to date have called for any kind of income assistance. All of the administration's plans have focused on refinancing subprime mortgages into prime mortgages, and that at this point, that's just not the problem for most people that are in this situation.
You say that what we need is a simple expansion and combination of two established programs. What are those programs, and what's your plan?
Sure. So the question you could ask is, why are prime mortgages, people with prime mortgages, why are they defaulting? And the answer is, we believe, is quite simple. It's that unemployment benefits are simply not large enough. So let me go through Wisconsin as an example. The typical mortgage payment in Wisconsin, this is averaged throughout the state and inclusive of property taxes, that's a number like $1,200 a month. Okay. Unemployment benefits, the maximum unemployment benefit in Wisconsin is $1,450 a month. So that means, suppose you have no other assets. If you pay your mortgage, $1,200 mortgage, you're left with $250 a month for everything else, food, clothing, heat, transportation. So this is why people are defaulting. Their unemployment benefits are simply not large enough to enable them to make a mortgage payment and have money left over for anything else. Mm-hmm. So what we're calling for is a supplement to unemployment insurance. And the supplement would be a housing voucher, and the housing voucher would be of the size such that people would spend 30% of their unemployment insurance on their mortgage. The voucher would cover the balance. So to give you an idea, in Wisconsin, we're calling for roughly a housing voucher of about $800. So that means that housing voucher comes in, the voucher is $800. To make the mortgage payment of $1,200, people spend $400 out of their unemployment benefits. That leaves them an extra $1,000 a month for food, clothing, transportation, etc. So I understand there were a lot of numbers thrown around there, but the basic idea is that mortgage sizes are too large relative to unemployment benefits. So we're calling for an expansion of unemployment benefits, and the expansion is a very specific form of a housing voucher. And so therefore, the housing voucher can only be used to make a mortgage payment. And we believe that this will, at least for the unemployed, that this will prevent, if this were implemented nationwide, we believe this would prevent on the order of 500,000 foreclosures per year.
Oh, my goodness.
So if the plan lasted 2 years, we believe it would prevent about 1 million foreclosures.
Mm-hmm. And in Wisconsin, to make it smaller, how many people do you think would be on such a program?
Well, right now there's 271,000 unemployed people in Wisconsin. That was August 2009. And we're estimating that only 42% of those collect unemployment benefits. So that's 111,000 in Wisconsin collecting unemployment benefits. And of those, we think that 50% of them have a mortgage. And these numbers come from research that we've done over the years. So right now, if this plan were in place right now, we'd expect 60,000 people in Wisconsin to receive a housing voucher.
It's still too many, but that's less than what I thought it was going to be. You as well? Did you think it would be fewer than that or more?
Well, the issue is who should get a voucher.
Mm-hmm.
So there's only 270,000 unemployed in Wisconsin. It's just not that big a state. To give you an idea, California, there's 2.2 million people unemployed, of which we think about 1 million people are collecting unemployment benefits. And of those 1 million people, we think about half of them have a mortgage. So in California, there would be 500,000 recipients of a housing voucher. So the reason Wisconsin sounds the numbers sound relatively small is there's just not that many people living in the state relative to a place like California.
Right. And then would you keep these people on a program for a limited amount of time? Otherwise, the cost might be exorbitant.
Well, we've worked through some cost scenarios. So we think that there's two things to say about costs. First, we're advocating no new money be spent on this program. What we're advocating is either the HAMP program, the Obama administration's current program to pay servicers to modify mortgages. We're arguing that that program should be shut down or at least greatly scaled back, and all of the money that's been allocated to that program be allocated to the Wisconsin plan. So $75 billion has been allocated to HAMP. The Wisconsin plan would basically call for a number like $60 billion spent over 2 years in the form of housing vouchers. And the reason, how did we get to $60 billion spent over 2 years? We got that number by assuming about $2.5 billion spent per month at current levels of unemployment and with our current guess for the voucher size. Now, that $2.5 billion per month, that's a variable that we can control through both the generosity of any individual payment and through who receives the payments and for how long. So something that's been proposed to us is that maybe people receive a housing voucher for 6 months at most. That would reduce program costs, but you should expect some foreclosures for people that have that are looking for work longer than 6 months. So there's this trade-off between program costs and how many foreclosures we think we can prevent through this program. And the $2.5 billion per month, what we're assuming is that anyone that receives unemployment as long as they receive unemployment benefits, they're eligible to get a housing voucher.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the $2.5 billion, if we scale that back to 6 months, then the cost of the program falls. But the number of foreclosures we might prevent might also fall. But the bottom line is, even in its most generous state, the most generous parameters, the way that we've outlined it, we think this program can be spent. It can be funded just by shifting money from the ineffective Obama administration's HAMP program to this program. So there'll be no new tax dollars involved.
Well, that's interesting. And tell me, I'm not familiar with, who are we now paying for services to deal with modifying mortgages? Who runs that program?
I think when people find out about this, they're going to be pretty angry.
Uh-oh.
I've had too much coffee this morning, but I always get a little upset when I hear about this. Right now, the way that the HAMP is the administration's name for its mortgage modification program. And the way that it works now is that the Treasury, I think it's the Treasury, pays mortgage servicers to modify mortgages. So that's the $75 billion that's been allocated. That's been allocated largely but not completely to pay mortgage servicers to modify mortgages. The actual payment to the mortgage servicers, I think this is true, is independent of the size of the mortgage modification. So the mortgage servicers potentially could make lots of relatively small and ineffective mortgage modifications to people that were unlikely to default anyway, and then they'd receive a check from the government.
Oh.
Now, what I've been told is that modifying a mortgage is so cumbersome for these servicers that they don't really want to do it. I've heard conflicting things. I've also heard that there are 500,000 trial modifications underway. But all of this is to say, I don't know why we're doing all these modifications. The point is, the fact of the matter is that in essence, because of the way the modification rules are written, the unemployed are ineligible to have their mortgage modified. So I don't know who we're modifying, but it isn't the unemployed. And you wouldn't want to modify the mortgage of the unemployed anyway. A modification is like a permanent gift. The unemployed are only temporarily unemployed. So, if we want to craft effective public policy to deal with the situation at hand, is that only 30% of the delinquent mortgages are from subprime mortgages. The rest have totally sensible mortgages. So the situation at hand says mortgage modification is not the issue. The issue is, for most people, they have a temporary disruption to income and the unemployment benefits are not high enough.
Well, why isn't anybody looking at that? The program they've put in place doesn't deal with the problem, from what you're saying.
It's been hard to get people to listen, honestly, frankly. I don't want to name names, but for a while when we were making phone calls, and the other thing is this is not a surprise. The Boston Fed has a plan on its website. That plan has been there since, I think, February. We knew this was coming. As soon as the foreclosure rate spiked after the financial crisis, we knew this was coming. And so when we talked about the perfect storm of foreclosures coming, that's old language. That was language that was in place in February and March. So the Boston Fed put a plan on its website in February. The original version of the Wisconsin plan was available in March. And whenever we called people, and I don't want to name names, but whenever we called people, maybe we called the wrong people. They kept talking about mortgage modifications and letters to Treasury and all this other stuff. I think we were talking to the wrong people, frankly. Recently, we've been in contact with some representatives from Wisconsin and from senators across the country, and they've begun to realize that these mortgage modifications aren't the issue. And so if you look at what's been proposed recently, Barney Frank's just come out with an announcement for $2 billion in loans to the unemployed. Senator Jack Reed in Rhode Island has come out with an announcement about $7 billion of loans to the unemployed. The plans yet haven't been fully fleshed out, and I think those numbers are way too small. We're going to need numbers like $36 billion a year. But the idea is, I think this idea that the unemployed need help is getting traction. So I'm very hopeful about that.
Yeah. And are you hopeful about the housing market as well?
Or not? Hopeful is, well, you know, you could ask, what does it mean to be hopeful? So I'm hopeful that it won't get... So here's what I mean by this. I am hopeful. I think house prices have bottomed. Now, the fact of the matter is that bottoming out is not good enough. House prices across the nation, on average, are 30% lower than when they were at their peak about 3 years ago. So just bottoming out is not good enough. There was a 30% decline that occurred over the past 3 years. This is why so many homeowners are underwater. So I'm hopeful that house prices have stabilized. I would advise young people thinking about buying their first home that now may not be a bad time to do that. And by the way, if you knew me, you'd say that was not the advice I was giving 3 years ago. But in terms of foreclosures, we are due, unless we take action now, foreclosure situation is going to get much worse. And it's going to be people that did all of the right things. They had prime loans. They put sensible down payments down. They had to. That was a prime loan. They had some bad luck that they got laid off in the midst of the worst recession since the Great Depression, mm-hmm. and they're going to lose their home. And in that sense, the housing crisis might get worse over the next 2 years, mm-hmm. unless we act now.
Yeah. And I wonder where those people who have already lost their homes, are you keeping track of them, or is anybody to find out where do they go?
I don't know where they go. One of the things that one of the senator's bills calls for is better data collection on foreclosures. The fact of the matter is we're relying on private surveys to get at what true foreclosure rates are. And some of the private surveys are notoriously inaccurate. So I've made statements about the foreclosure crisis, about public policy, et cetera, based on data that I have provided by private markets. There's no way to know if that data is really accurate or not. Probably the gross trends in the data are accurate, but the exact numbers may not be. So one of the bills has called for basically somebody in the federal government to start keeping accurate data. And you might argue that part of this accurate data collection should involve tracking people that have been foreclosed on and finding out what they do with their shelter situation.
Yes.
I haven't seen that in any bill, but I think the language is now, these bills are now just in their infancy. So if there's a true demand for this, then maybe the language of the bills will change.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Professor Morris Davis, Assistant Professor of Real Estate and Urban Land Economics at the Wisconsin School of Business, UW-Madison. He's worked as an economist at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington. He has outlined all of his research and given briefings to former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan. We're looking at what he believes we need, which is a simple expansion and combination of two established programs, unemployment insurance and housing vouchers, to prevent a new wave of foreclosures of recently unemployed workers. And as we all know, there are many of them with the unemployment rate close now to 10%. The Wisconsin Foreclosure and Unemployment Relief Plan is what we're talking about, and we're welcoming phone calls for our guest. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Professor Morris Davis, Assistant Professor of Real Estate and Urban Land Economics at the Wisconsin School of Business, UW-Madison. We also want to let you know that we have his report on our website. So if you're interested in reading this, it's at WPR.org. Go to my link, Kathleen Dunn, and there will be a posting of this, which is, oh, this modern technology, it's pretty great, huh? Let's go to phone calls, starting with Rick from Ladysmith. Hi, Rick.
Good morning, Kathleen. Let me just start by saying I just love your guest. Finally, we got a man who actually understands the intricacies of the American capitalist economic system. I'd like to make two major points. Number one, a full 9 months before this credit crisis crescendoed, I went to a public meeting with Representative Dave Obey from Northern Wisconsin, who's one of the most powerful members of Congress, and I told him that I was scared stiff about what was happening to the American economy. There had been a professor on the BBC at about 3 o'clock in the morning lecturing on this problem from London, who understood what was going to happen to the United States economy, you know, in several months. So I explained this to Obey at this public meeting, and I even had a suggestion for him as to at least how to begin to deal with people losing their houses, and that was one of those alphabet soup agencies that President Franklin Roosevelt had. And, I mean, that was just to get him started on this, you know. Heck, I would have gone home with the guy and talked to him for hours about it. And he complimented me on it and said, what is a good idea, and absolutely did nothing about it. You know, frankly, I think we got a bunch of lawyers in the Congress. They don't understand anything about the American economy. My second point is that I think that President Obama, who may be a well-meaning man, I think he did just an absolutely horrible thing by giving these trillions of dollars to these corrupt banking officials. By pouring all this money in from the top into the banks, they have absolutely no incentive to deal in an ethical way with any of these people that have underwater mortgages, many of which were sold under fraud.
Okay, thanks very much for your comments. Professor Davis.
Rick, thanks very much for your comment. You know, let me just give you some background. People that know me wouldn't really describe me as, like, the most liberal guy they've ever heard. If you know anything about economists, I've been trained in the freshwater camp. But I do believe that there's a role for government in responding to aggregate shocks. So, for example, when Hurricane Katrina, came and wiped out much of New Orleans, there was no question that the government should step in and help rebuild Katrina. There just was no insurance agency that was large enough to do that job or was skilled enough. So there are occasions in our economy when the federal government takes action in response to large shocks. So regardless of what that BBC professor in England said on the BBC, you could argue that we've had two very large shocks. The first was the decline in house prices of 30%. It's not that people didn't think that that was a poss that there was a possibility. We always knew there was a possibility that a hurricane would wipe out New Orleans. It's just it was assigned a low probability. Now, maybe we got that probability wrong, but it occurred, and because it was a low probability event that occurred, and that can be viewed as a shock. The second shock that we've had is a 10% unemployment rate. People, economists, totally sensible people studying the data, had basically claimed that this kind of large recession was very unlikely based on the data that we had previous. This is the largest recession that we've had since the Great Depression by some metrics. So it's true, it was always possible. It was just a low probability event, and that's why we can view it as a shock. So we've had two large aggregate shocks, and because of those two large shocks, you can argue that maybe there's a role for government. And people that the last thing I'll say is this idea that I've always been behind foreclosure relief, not that any of the listeners would know me, but I'll just state this. In 2007 and 2008, when the foreclosures started coming in, I was asked on Wisconsin Public Radio what we should do, and I said nothing. We should let the people that are being foreclosed on be foreclosed on. And the reason I made that statement and the reason that I've changed my opinion is that the early waves of foreclosures in 07 and 08, they were from people that put very little money down on their house. So they basically got to live. Imagine you put no money down on your house. If the house price goes up, you keep all the gains. If the house price falls, not only do you lose nothing through limited liability and non-recourse, but you live in the house for free while the foreclosure process takes place. So early on, I was advocating, maybe a bit too forcefully, that we should be doing nothing. My position has changed because in the fall last year, we experienced this big recession, and governments should respond when there are big aggregate shocks. Anyway, that's one point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to state that because I don't want to claim that the government should always try to reduce foreclosures and all this other stuff. I want to say this is a policy crafted in response to two aggregate shocks that we've had.
Let's go next to Porter from Madison. Hi, Porter.
Hi. My question is, you are addressing the unemployed, and my concern is the permanently unemployed through medical disability, either 100% or 50% or partially disabled, because a short-term 6 months of help won't help us because we are permanently disabled.
Yeah, I'm not going to sound like a nice guy very now. So there's a question about who should receive help and when. I don't know the right answer for this. There is a thought out there that if you need temporary assistance, you get temporary assistance. But that if you experience a permanent shock, I'm just saying this is a thought that maybe your lifestyle has to change. And what does that mean to change the lifestyle? It means that maybe you move to a smaller house. Now, what you'd say to me, and it would be correct, is that you can't move to a smaller house because you're underwater. Not you, but a person right now who had their house price fall so that their house is worth less than their mortgage, they can't move. Because if they sell their house, they have to write the bank a check at closing. So I don't have any policy in mind to help people that have experienced a permanent shock to their income through disability. And obviously, that's not something I would ever wish to have happen on anyone. But I don't. This program's not designed to help people that have had a permanent shock.
Thank you, and best of luck to you, Porter. Doesn't your program mean that in order for it to be successful, you have to move back into the job market fairly quickly? And I'm wondering if people are able to do that and if they're able to find salaries that are comparable to what they had when they were laid off.
Well, what we had in mind was that the voucher is given to people that are currently collecting unemployment benefits. So, you know, we've seen extensions of unemployment benefits precisely because it does not appear that firms are posting vacancies or firms are hiring at a rapid enough rate. So I my view on this is as long as unemployment benefits keep getting extended, then the housing voucher should be sent along with those unemployment benefits until firms start hiring again. Did that answer the question?
It did. Thank you. Sherry from Green Bay. Hi, Sherry.
Good morning. My question, I'm kind of on the other side of the fence. We are actually trying to purchase a home that is currently in the short sale process. The sellers are trying to avoid foreclosure. Just wondering if you have any advice on how to speed that process up, because we don't want to wait 6 months to a year.
I don't have any advice for you. I'm sorry. I could say stuff, but it would probably be unhelpful. But good luck with the house purchase.
Thanks very much for the call. When you talked about circulating this idea among congressional members here in the state of Wisconsin, are you getting nibbles on this? Are there people? I'm wondering how the process happens, how we would change course from something that doesn't seem to be working to something that might work.
Okay. Yeah, I will. Part of it was just attempting to reach out to different members. I will say that we've had a fantastic relationship with Representative Gwen Moore's office in Milwaukee. And that turned out to be extremely, I don't want to put any words in Representative Moore's mouth. She may or may not agree with the plan. She may or may not agree with what we're saying, but she was very receptive and open and helpful. And we've been in touch with her staff. And the reason that turned out to be, we think, a helpful connection is that Representative Moore is on the House Financial Services Committee, and so she sits in the same committee with Barney Frank and others. So Representative Moore also understood to some extent, I believe, well understood, but that the issue with refinancing mortgages was not actually stopping the foreclosures.
Mm-hmm.
So, we tried other people. Wasn't as successful, but Representative Moore has been very receptive to this. We think, and again, I don't want to put any words in anyone's mouth, but at least we had an audience with her and have been in constant contact with her since.
And tell me a little bit more, I know that you deal with this issue in your report too, about the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development that does oversee a system of allowances, sort of like food stamps that go through the local public housing authorities. Would your program sort of be a part of that? Would it make sense to put it there? And how large is that program right now that helps people who are quite poor with housing subsidy?
So that program is quite small. There is a program for housing vouchers. There's a waiting list. And it's kind of a totally different program. It was for people that were, it was not designed as temporary. Well, it was not designed in response to a big recession. It's just a program that's out there. That program has a reputation for being quite successful. And in fact, my colleague Steve Malpezzi was the one who originally suggested that the aid should be given in the form of a housing voucher, based on his knowledge of that. In terms of who actually administers the housing voucher, we've gotten this question, like, how would it actually work? And we could suggest how it would actually work, which is that the state unemployment agencies send to the federal government their list of people currently collecting unemployment insurance. Each of those people then gets a housing voucher in the mail, and the amount of the voucher would depend on the county where they live. And we have all of those county level calculations detailed on the website for the Wisconsin plan. Now, the question is, who actually prints the voucher? Who mails it out? That's something we don't really have any stake in. We just argue that it be done efficiently. So if it makes more sense that the state unemployment agencies write the housing voucher checks and then are reimbursed from the federal government, if that's less costly to administer than HUD or some other federal government agency doing it, we would just say whatever the least costly way to administer this program, that's the way it should be done.
Mm-hmm.
But this housing voucher program would be totally different, funded with new money, than the existing HUD housing voucher program, which was designed to serve a different purpose.
I see. Steve is next. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Yeah, my question is concerning how would you adjust for seasonal unemployment, in particular, like construction workers and things of that nature? And also, if the professor would answer what is considered full employment. It's been some time since I was in an economics class, but it used to be around 4.5%, I believe. If you'd be able to answer those, I'll take the answers off the air.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Steve, those are fantastic questions. we need to hire you right away to help us out. See, you know, we have no way of separating seasonal unemployment from regular unemployment. We haven't allowed for that, partly because we've tried to design a plan that would be quick to administer. What is that? Something needs to be done today, basically today, if we want to prevent foreclosures, the surge of foreclosures from coming in the wintertime. And, you know, what we had in mind is let's do this today and then refine it. Let's get the checks in the mail today. It's like getting the boots on the ground. Let's get it in the mail today and then figure out how to refine it and reduce program costs as the months elapse. And one of the, you know, maybe we want to separate people that are seasonally unemployed from those that are have truly been laid off and are actually looking for work in any industry. In terms of full employment, that's a moving target. There's this debate about, there's this old so-called natural rate of unemployment. I'm not a, I don't know what those words mean, but I think if somebody were to say the rate of unemployment when GDP growth is growing at around trend, that would be a number like 5%. But you could easily see 4.5 there, and you could easily see 6. So, but anyway, it's much less than 10 is the bottom line.
And thanks for your call. We go next to Don from Green Bay. Hi, Don.
Yes, I want to make two suggestions to you. First of all, if some of these people would get lawyers, we have good mortgage laws here, and those lawyers can keep them in their house for 8 months while that lawyer from Milwaukee is trying to figure out what to do and who owns the mortgage. The second thing I'd like to say is that we got too much representation without taxation. But I think on this situation, it would be nice if they would take a lien of 25% of what they get and put that on the house so that they know they got responsibility to pay for it, and then maybe 1% interest a year.
So, Don, thanks for the call. I guess that's something Kathleen should have said. But
we can both say it. Don, thanks for the call.
I will say this. There's been some debate about whether or not any assistance to the unemployed to help them pay their mortgage should be a loan or a grant. Mm. So if you look at the Boston Fed proposal, there's only two proposals out there, the Wisconsin proposal and the Boston Fed proposal. The Boston Fed proposal, one of the proposals calls for assistance to be a loan. I'd support that too. I actually think many of the people that are unemployed, they don't want any kind of permanent assistance. They just need a little help right now to help make the mortgage payment. The one thing I'd say about that is currently unemployment benefits, we all pay for them in the form of a tax. And then when one of us is unemployed, we basically get a check written to us. So the way to view unemployment now is that it's an insurance scheme. It's not a gift from taxpayers to the unemployed. It's, you know, you're making a claim on your uninsurance. If we think of this voucher as a supplement to the unemployment insurance, then maybe we'd want to think of it the same way. We all pay our taxes, and then if a shock hits us such that we have a claim on our insurance, we get the insurance claim mailed to us. We don't have to repay it. It's just there's different ways to think about what it is that unemployment insurance is trying to do. And so, but we, you know, if the unemployed got temporary help that they had to repay, I would fully be behind that. It's just we have to decide what it is that unemployment insurance is there for and what it should try to do.
Professor Morris Davis, our guest, assistant professor of real estate and urban land economics at the Wisconsin School of Business, UW-Madison. And we're talking about the Wisconsin foreclosure and unemployment relief plan, which you can find on our website, too, at WPR.org, which he believes would be a much better plan than what the administration has going now, which is rather incomplete. So we're talking about what it is. We have a couple lines open if you've been trying to get through. The number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow on our program, we will be speaking with, we have two authors tomorrow. Rabbi Harold Kushner will be with us, one of our hours, and also the author of Barack and Michelle, Portrait out of an American Marriage. So those are the hours tomorrow. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. And we go to Jan from Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, Jan.
Hi. This is very interesting, and this might be just a tad off of your area there, Professor, but I really feel it's a really important point for everybody to realize that the current statistics for unemployment are just that. They're very current, and they do not take in the entire scope of people who have been unemployed past the time when their benefits run out. But that's the only statistics that benefits like this and programs like you're talking about are looking at. And so, you know, for the people with gray hair who were let go 5 years ago, and I know six of them right offhand, where, you know, they're living on their spouse's income, and that's being bolstered by credit cards, and they can't get unemployment except sporadic to go help out this guy with the concrete or whatever. So they don't qualify to get unemployment again. They're off the grid, but they are unemployed. And so the unemployment statistics we see are not accurate, and programs like this are not helping those people. What do you think about that?
Yeah, Jan, this is another point. I think people are aware of this, but they're at a loss to know exactly what to do. So what Jan's point is to be counted as unemployed, you have to be in the labor force. Now, the question is, what does it mean to be in the labor force? It means you have to be looking for work. So imagine you're on the eve of retirement and you're let go. And then you realize nobody will hire you, so you're out of the labor force, yet it's because you're not looking for work, yet you would like to earn some income. Or you could imagine, suppose somebody was laid off a year and a half ago, and they looked for work for 8 months, and then they just gave up. They would be not counted in the unemployment statistics because they wouldn't necessarily be in the labor force because they're not looking for work. So I think the question, so let's talk about two things. The first is, why did the Wisconsin plan focus on the unemployed receiving unemployment insurance? The reason we did that was because it was a quickly identifiable group of people that we knew were actively looking for work. And under this guise that we have to work extremely fast to prevent the next wave of foreclosures. That's why the plan was written in February. But at the time, we thought we had to work extremely fast to prevent the next wave of foreclosures. So we identified the group of people that were quickly identifiable. If we think that long-term unemployment is a problem, and I think most people would agree that long-term unemployment is a problem, then we need to figure out some way of identifying the people that, if job prospects were better, they'd have a job, or they'd at least look for a job. I don't think we know how to do that. We know that people will say that they would gladly look for a job if jobs were available, but in the parlance of economics, that's just cheap talk. What we want to see are people actively looking for work along some dimensions to guarantee that they're actually in the labor force. So this is a problem. It's a problem of identifying people that want to work, but that simply can't exert the effort. They don't bother exerting the effort because there's basically no chance that they could get a job that would help them. And I understand that there's some debate about whether or not a person can jump into any job at any time at the minimum wage, whether or not we even want that as a society. But if you think about what the Wisconsin plan's trying to do, it's trying to help people that can be quickly identified as needing help and aren't receiving it right now. And that's why we focus on the unemployed receiving unemployment insurance.
Thanks very much for your call, Jan. John from Menominee is next. Hi, John.
Hello. I'm wondering what kind of screening is in this plan for people. You know, you might have some unemployed like me that actually planned ahead and put money in the savings and is living off of that, but, you know, so I don't need that mortgage voucher. So what kind of screening or process would take place to see if somebody needs it?
Well, again, this comes down to whether or not we think of this as just you pay your taxes, and when there's a shock, you receive an insurance payment, regardless of whether you need it or not. So think about a wealthy person that has home insurance. Their roof has a hole in it. They collect on the insurance payment. even though they may not need the help. They may have enough assets in the bank to pay for the hole in the roof themselves. So one way to think about what unemployment in general is, it's not a means-tested program. It's literally insurance. If you work and then you're unemployed, you get an unemployment insurance check independent of the amount of assets that you have. We have in mind that for the housing voucher program. Now, we understand the point, though. The claim is that the foreclosures are occurring because for the unemployed, because people have spent down their assets. They basically, at that point, they have no resources left to pay their mortgage because unemployment benefits aren't large enough. So we understand that that's our reasoning for why the unemployed are foreclosing in large numbers. The reason that we, and again, this is also the reason that we're not instituting a means test, or at least we didn't in the original version of the plan, was we thought of this as just a benefit you receive because you pay taxes. Now, you could say, let's add a means test. I guess I would be okay with that. I would just argue it would be extremely hard to implement. And again, speed is of the essence right now.
And when would you know if things got really rosy for whatever reason in the next couple of years? What would this plan be something that would just be in the on the shelf and something would trigger it so it would be permanent or not?
Well, I wouldn't advocate anything be permanent. Frankly, we don't know. We have no certainty that it will be effective. This is just based on a theory of unemployment, a theory of foreclosures. Mm-hmm. Now, based on the available data. So the advice that I give is let's plan on 6 months of this, which would cost on the order of somewhere between $12 and $20 billion. Let's just plan on 6 months of it to be funded from HAMP. Let's see if it does what we claim that it's going to do. If it's successful, we extend the program. And then we can decide as a society when unemployment rates return to more normal levels or house prices increase to the point where people are no longer underwater or more homeowners. The percentage of homeowners underwater falls, then we can talk about just sunsetting the program or letting it expire. I wouldn't advocate that anything be a permanent part of any safety net until we have some experience with the program.
You're fairly confident, of course, or you wouldn't have put this much effort into it, that it would be successful, right?
Yeah, this is the reason. There's two reasons we're doing this. First is we've had big aggregate shocks. There should be an effective public policy response. And we've committed to spend money. So the question is, what should the right public policy response look like? And the second is, we're spending money on mortgage servicers. We're cutting these guys' checks. So we've committed to spend money, so let's spend it effectively. Mm-hmm. We cannot guarantee anything because this has never been done before. But all of the data that we have on hand, my credibility is a little bit on the line. And
sure.
I've worked pretty hard for that. So all of the available data that we have suggests that this is going to be effective at reducing foreclosures. And that's why we're pushing it.
Thanks, John, for the call. We have time for maybe one more phone call. Joey from La Crosse. Hi.
I wanted to relay that we're not unemployed, but we have a small business in La Crosse, and it's not doing well. So we went. My wife approached our mortgage servicer for a loan modification, and I didn't think the talks were going to go very far because our business is so slow. But it's interesting enough that we have a 7-year ARM, and it's going to be due next summer. And the first attempt, or what he's trying to steer us towards, is doing a 30-year fixed, and then collecting $4,000 and whatever closing cost. And he hasn't even brought up the modification plan that you were talking about.
Yeah, Joey, you know what? If people knew the anecdotes that I've been getting, there would be a huge cry. Mm. So I'll tell you one. There's a bank out there. It's collecting TARP money. And there was a $100,000 mortgage balance from a person that had never missed a payment. Okay, all this person wanted to do was refi to a slightly lower rate. Okay, this person was at 6%. So this bank that's collecting TARP money or collected TARP money, they offered a reduction from 6% to 5 7/8% and wanted to charge $2,500 in fees. Okay. Yeah. And on a $100,000 mortgage balance. And when and it wasn't sold into a secondary market. This was a loan that this bank held on its books. So the HAMP laws allow not only do the mortgage servicers receive a check from the government, but they're allowed to charge fees for underwriting the refinance. And I thought the maximum fee that was allowable by law was $2,500, which, of course, they're all charging. I've never heard a fee of, as you mentioned, $4,500. There's one thing, though, that I don't know your situation, but there's one thing I'll say. People have in mind that these ARMs are going to reset and there's going to be exploding payments. That's not true. So if you look at the typical way that the mortgage contract is written, the mortgage, an ARM is written as a when the interest rate can adjust, which will happen soon for many people, the contract specifies that the new rate will be equal to some base rate plus a markup. So the base rate can be typically a treasury or something called LIBOR, and the markup's on the order of 200 basis points.
We only have 10 seconds.
Sorry, LIBOR is now at zero. Okay, and so your rate might adjust to a number like 2%. So you might actually want to hold, if you have an ARM, look at its terms, you might want to hold on to it. I don't know your situation.
And we have to end at this point. Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor Davis, for being with us. Interesting hour. Yeah, it's a different idea. Thanks to Professor Morris Davis and to Rob Schroeder for producing and on-air production.